Today's story from Luke's Gospel makes clear where Peter and John and all the rest of us disciples of Jesus got the impression that everybody matters and that our small acts of attentiveness make a world of difference. This is Luke chapter 13, verses 10 through 17. Now, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and just then there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are free from your ailment." When he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. But the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" When he said this, all his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at all the wonderful things he was doing. 18 years with no help. 18 years of staring at the ground because her body would not allow her to straighten up and look around. 18 years of having to make her painful way in the world, bent over and invisible to others. And then Jesus arrives. In the midst of a crowd, he notices her and calls out, "You, woman over there in the back corner against the wall. Yeah, you are free from whatever it is that's been causing you to suffer." The significance of being noticed is no small thing. Likewise, the willingness to reach out in concern and compassion can be a tremendously transformative gesture. Over the centuries, those seeking to live Christ-like lives have learned these lessons in many different ways, some through direct personal experience, and some through wise and revelatory stories, which have been told and retold to guide us on our way. A story that emerged from the era of King Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table is the story of Percival, a knight whose quest to do good was sometimes fulfilled and sometimes frustrated. Long ago, as Percival traveled through the land of the Britons, doing battle and then sending those he conquered to pledge their loyalty to King Arthur, he happened upon the home of the Fisher King, a desolate and barren place which few were ever allowed to enter. Percival was directed to the castle. He was introduced to the Fisher King himself. The king was weak and ailing, as he suffered from a large and obvious chest wound that bled continually. Percival was welcomed with tremendous hospitality. A great banquet was laid in his honor, and during the banquet, he was actually permitted to glimpse the Holy Grail, that sacred cup symbolizing the place where life flows into the world. As the banquet began, everyone in the castle seemed to be in high spirits, and Percival wondered many things. He wondered how the king had been wounded and why nothing was being done to stop his bleeding in his chest. He wondered why he himself was being welcomed and honored with such fanfare. He wondered about the cup and why it was treated with such respect and honor and why it was so carefully guarded and protected. But because someone had told him in the course of his training that it was rude to ask questions, and that a good knight should keep his mouth shut, Percival didn't ask any of the things that were on his heart that night. As the evening wore on, the mood in the castle changed from excitement and anticipation to disappointment and even despondency. When the banquet was over, Percival was given a place to sleep. And when he woke up in the morning, he discovered that the people and the cup and the king had all vanished. Only later did he learn that he himself had missed a chance to heal the wound of the Fisher King and to restore life and joy to that desolate kingdom. All he needed to do was ask one question. And the reason the banquet started out with such anticipation and joy is because the people thought, surely this traveler, this stranger, this knight in our midst is going to ask the question that's going to change everything. He just needed to ask one question and the bleeding would have stopped. The trees and the flowers would have begun to grow again. The question that he was meant to ask and didn't, thus turning the mood to despair, was simply, "What ails you, O my king? What ails you?" Too often, it's a question we ourselves fail to ask. We might sense that a person is in distress, but we don't ask what's wrong because we don't want to appear rude or snoopy. We might see obvious signs of trouble, but we don't ask because we're reluctant to get involved. We pretend not to see pleas for help because we can't quite figure out what we ought to say or how we ought to act. And so wounded people all around us never receive the benefit or the healing power of even one simple expression of care. Percival wasn't asked to go to great lengths. All he had to do was notice what was going on and give voice to his concern. "Wow, I see you've got a gaping chest wound and your life seems to be draining away. What happened? What's the matter?" That question alone would have been enough. The recognition of pain would have made all the difference for the Fisher King. Having Percival say, in essence, "I'm here and I care," would have brought healing to the king and to his land. Jesus, we probably have noticed, was not hindered by any thought that he should avoid embarrassing people by drawing attention to their problems. Nor was he stopped or limited by what he surely knew was the likelihood that he would be severely criticized. He's in the synagogue. It's the Sabbath. There are people everywhere. And when he sees a woman who's bent over and can't stand up straight, he doesn't go sneaking through the crowd and whispering in her ear. He shouts out, "Woman, over here, you are free from your ailment." He not only sees her and shouts out to her, he manages to get close enough to touch her. And in that moment, she's healed. We know from other gospel accounts that there was incredible power in Jesus' touch. But I wonder if some of that power wasn't his simple willingness to care, to speak up, to get involved. Sometimes I think we avoid the pain of the people around us and avoid the pain of the world we live in because the problems seem too big and too overwhelming. It seems impossible that we could do anything to make a difference. We know the problem's been going on for years, maybe decades. Other people have probably tried to do something, and yet here the problem still persists. What could we possibly do about it? Jesus offers another possibility. Maybe our words and our actions matter more than we think. Maybe we can make a difference, especially if our words and actions are offered in response to God's great love for us. Jesus' action tipped the balance for that suffering woman. She was healed and she began praising God. Perhaps our actions could tip the balance. Perhaps we are not as powerless as we think. Consider the experience of a Dutch prisoner of war, remembered by priest and teacher Henry Nouwen. This soldier was captured and taken far from his homeland. He was isolated, cut off from contact with his family and friends, of course, not knowing really whether anyone at home was still alive, uncertain as to how his country was faring or whether it still existed. He had 1,000 questions and no way to answer any of them. And so he fell into despair, not being able to find anything left to live for. And then one day, some way, somehow, he received a letter. was all crumpled up and mashed and dirty because it had traveled so long and so far to reach him. With trembling hands, he opened that letter and read these words. "We're all waiting for you here at home. Everything's okay. Don't worry. We're looking forward to your return. We can't wait to see you." Now, certainly the Red Cross or whatever equivalent organization made it possible for that letter to be delivered receives a tremendous credit as well. But Henry Nouwen's observation is that writing simple words in a short letter saved a life. The external circumstances of that soldier's life had not changed. He was still in prison, still isolated, still continuing to labor and endure difficult things. And yet he now felt completely different. Someone desired to see him. Someone was waiting for him. He still had a home. Hope was reborn. Now there was a reason to survive. If we've ever thought that our attempts to express care or concern wouldn't matter or make much difference, we should think again. We have more to share in the way of faith and encouragement than we perhaps have allowed ourselves to realize. Our words of kindness have more power than we know. A particularly challenging example of this truth emerged in Nebraska in the early 1990s. It's challenging because it invites us to view even our enemies as potential recipients of God's grace through us. In 1991, soon after moving to Lincoln, Nebraska, to become the musical worship leader of a local Jewish synagogue, Michael Weiser and his family began to receive threatening phone calls and mysterious deliveries of hate mail to their home. When they reported these incidents to the police identified the notes and the pictures all the threats as the work of Larry Trapp, who at that time was the state leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Mr. Trapp was viewed by the police as extremely dangerous, for although he had not yet been caught, it was believed that he was the one who had built the explosives and directed the bombings which had destroyed the homes of several African Americans in Lincoln, as well as the Indochinese Refugee Assistance Center in Omaha. It was also known that Larry had plans to blow up the Weiser's synagogue. At that time, Larry Trapp was 44 years old. He was confined to a wheelchair because of extremely advanced diabetes, but that had not stopped him from assembling a large supply of weapons or from producing a white supremacist TV series on the local cable channel. When Michael Weiser turned on the TV one day and saw a burning swastika, he'd had about as much as he could take. And so he called Larry Trapp's house, and he left a message on the answering machine. "Larry," he said, "do you know that the very first laws that Hitler's Nazis passed were against people like yourself who had no legs or who had physical deformities or physical handicaps? Do you realize that you would have been among the first to die under Hitler? Why do you love the Nazis so much?" Larry didn't answer the phone while that message was being left, but Michael kept calling until one day Larry did answer the phone. "Who are you and what do you want?" Larry demanded to know. "Are you black?" "I'm Jewish," answered Michael. And then, inspired by suggestion from his wife Julie, he said, "I was thinking you might need a hand with something. I wondered if I could help. I know you're in a wheelchair. I thought maybe I could take you to the grocery store or something." At first, Larry was so surprised he couldn't speak. But finally, he managed to say, "That's okay. I got it covered." Michael took this as an opening to continue to call Larry, to express concern, to challenge him on his ideology of hatred. Finally, one day, after Larry'd been on the radio espousing the same old thing, a turning point came. Michael called to express his anger and his disappointment, which basically boiled down to, "Larry, what is the matter with you?" And Larry apologized. "I've been talking like this all my life. I'm sorry. I can't seem to help it. I want to get out, but I don't know how." Michael already had his whole synagogue praying for Larry. And at this point, he offered to bring his family over to Larry's house for a personal visit. "Let's break bread together," he said. And Larry allowed him to come. It was a night of tears and laughter when the two men finally met face to face for the first time. And after that night, Larry resigned from all the racist organizations that he led or belonged to. He confessed the crimes he had committed. He wrote apologies to all of the people that he had threatened, harmed, and abused. And 2 months later, Larry learned that he had less than a year to live. The Weisers invited him to leave his tiny efficiency apartment and move in with them and their three children. They nursed him through his last months. And when he died, he was not only their friend, but also a member of their synagogue and a believer in the power of love. I discovered that story in a book by Walter Wink, who offers the commentary that hatred and violence is caused by unhealed wounds, and that individual actions, such as those of the Weiser family, play an indispensable role in the healing of nations. Because we are all children of a loving God, we all carry within us the power to heal. That power might be unleashed by honest and heartfelt questions, such as, "What ails you, my friend?" Or by gestures of faith, such as writing a hopeful letter and sending it out into the world with prayer. Or simply by seeing and by reaching out to those that nobody else is noticing or caring about, as Peter and John, and much later Michael and his family, did when they said to an unknown stranger, "Take my hand and let me help you." Jesus, in a shining example of listening to God and not to his critics, did not hesitate to call out and extend a hand to a long-suffering woman. Holy God, thank you for shaping us into a people who can share your love and grace in healing ways with the world. Today, as we worship, we're mindful of friends and co-workers and loved ones experiencing frightening illness, job loss, grief, and change, where our words and presence can be an encouragement, prompt us to speak up, to show up. We're aware of deep suffering around the world due to floods and fires, O God, and so we ask that you keep alive in us the ability to see as fellow human beings all those facing catastrophe in places as far from us as Pakistan, Moscow, China, and Bolivia. As always, Lord, but especially this week, as a milestone was reached, we are conscious of sacrifices made by our fellow countrymen and women throughout the last several years of war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Help us, God, to find generous ways to reach out to sailors, soldiers, Marines, and their families. And Lord, may we never dismiss the poor, the homeless, the addicted, the elderly, or the sick as insignificant or unworthy of your attention and our attention. We're grateful that you have extended a hopeful word and a saving hand to us, and we're honored by the opportunity to magnify your presence in the world. Jesus, we love you. We worship and adore you. Together now we pray the prayer that you taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen. In some versions of the story of Percival and the Fisher King, the knight gets another chance. He seeks the counsel of someone who can advise him, and he learns how to allow his sense of compassion to rise to the surface. He makes his way back into that desolate kingdom, and this time, when he stands before the wounded king, he asks the question that makes the difference. "I see you're bleeding," he says. "What ails you? What's the matter?" And with that, health is restored to the king and to the kingdom.